Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
Hey there, listeners. A quick word up top. I kind of botched this recording. I didn't realize until way too late that only Mindy's side was recording. So I've pulled as much audio wizardry as I could to salvage my side of it through her mic, but it will sound different. That said, it's only the first half, so if it really bothers you, you could jump ahead to the second half that we recorded at Mindy's place, and that part of the show is normal as can be. So yeah, I don't know what exactly went wrong. It's an X-Files mystery. Welcome back, listeners. Before we jump into the episode, we do want to give a big shout out and thank you to Patreon patrons who support us over at patreon.com/rancemacabre, where we've got a sort of alternate library of content which sits to them. So for a buck a month, you can join them at Patreon. For this month, we had Telephone Terror. And then we're moving into a series on our road to 25.
Yes.
We have individually selected our personal top 25, and then by the end of all the fighting and struggling, we will have a uniform, official Rance Macabre top 25.
Right. The official one is going to be on this part of our podcast, but the road leading up to it, that's exclusively Patreon. And let me tell you, I thought it would be a little bit easier than it's becoming.
My list.
Yeah, and I was like, my list looks like nothing like your list.
I think mine, I'll admit, it's a more traditional 25. And I showed you, top 50,
right,
something like that I started with, but the top 25, it's reminiscent of more old-fashioned opinions, I suppose
mine is pretty eclectic, but I think mine's a good list. I don't know. Anyway, you guys drop on over to Patreon and check it out and let me know what you think.
All right, so let's begin. So I texted you about this episode that it was definitely the most self-indulgent and just fun, just tapped into pure fun in doing this episode, and it felt like I was getting away with something.
And I think that's going forward the idea we need to have for everything.
Yeah, I did like that idea. So we are talking X-Files today. So in prepping for this episode, we didn't have a specific theme as far as Monster of the Week episodes.
X-Files. The theme is X-Files.
Favorite X-Files. Yeah. So we both chose two as a sort of cross-section of our favorite stuff. And this was a lot of fun to work.
Much like our list, though, it was like once we chose these, then I thought, oh, I forgot about this one, and I forgot about this one.
So sort of popping up.
Yeah, I
did wind up watching a ton more than the couple that we'll talk about. So when it comes to X-Files, the first names you think of are probably Chris Carter or David Duchovny or Gillian Anderson. And a lot has been said about all of them. So I wanted to throw some love to the best writers and directors that made the show what it was. Well, when the show was at its best.
Yes.
So like George Lucas, Chris Carter established a great premise and a solid framework that allowed for incredible storytelling. But also like George Lucas, some of the best work relative to his creation was done by other people. So some of the most notable writers and pillars of the show, I want to talk about James Wong, Glenn Morgan. Together, those two worked on 21 Jump Street. I thought it was a funny place to jump off of relationship, but they clearly recruited the captain, Stephen Williams, as the original Mr. X. I always remember him as the captain from 21 Jump Street. He even popped up in Supernatural, which they also went on to work on. We've got Frank Spotnitz, who wrote a bunch of episodes and the X-Files movie. He also went on to write for Millennium. We've got Howard Gordon, who wrote 17 episodes. And also, I think when they give individual credit, it's like they did the bulk of the work, but these guys are all chipping in to, big stories. Vince Gilligan, of Breaking Bad fame.
Yeah.
who together with Spotness and Chris Carter and John Sheeman co-created The Lone Gunman.
Yeah.
Which were, I always felt like they were like an underutilized. I mean, they got their TV show and that didn't even get its full run on Fox. Like,
Short shrift. It was not good, the TV show. And, you know, I watched this entire series not that long ago. Maybe a year ago, I watched everything start to finish. And the way that the storyline for The Lone Gunman ended could have been so good, but then it wasn't. And then I was mad. And I'm still obviously mad about it. I'm still thinking about it.
It's kind of awful that, like, it also closed a book on them.
Mm-hmm.
We don't expect to see. I don't know. The show got so bizarre in the 10th season that, like, they can bring him back from the dead. I don't give a fuck. I just want to see him.
Yeah, but you never. X-Files kind of stops on ghosts. We don't really get ghosts, you know?
But they've reanimated Mulder. Scully's sort of coming on. She's been in any number of alien spaceships.
I mean, the one thing, there's all these writers and some of them really great, great TV writers on this, but the universe for the X-Files is so terrible. It's so incongruent. Nothing makes sense. Exactly. Like, when you literally watch it start to finish, the show is not made to be binge-watched.
Every couple of seasons, I feel like they do, like, an alien recap show.
Right.
Yeah, the musings of the cigarette-smoking man, and the finale really tries to wedge a lot of things together.
Yeah.
They do recognize that, like, they need to check in with people about the ongoing alien conspiracy. Frankly, those are the ones I like the least.
Yeah, no, Monster of the Week is really my favorite part, because when it really gets into the nuts and bolts of the congruent nature of the universe, it's a freaking mess.
It's aliens taking sides, it's humans negotiating.
Right.
Breeds.
And Scully is, like, invincible, actually.
Yeah.
But everyone forgets about that, and then the super soldiers are, like, this whole other thing that doesn't make any sense. Whatever.
So, going back to writers, we left off with Vince Gilligan, who wrote the Bryan Cranston episode where it's essentially like Speed, but Bryan Cranston's head's gonna explode.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's kind of where he had those memories of Cranston that he wanted to bring into Breaking Bad. It's a good episode. It's kind of creepy, and Cranston knocks it out of the park. All right, more writers. We got the younger brother, Darren Morgan, who, brother to Glenn Morgan, is a huge Monster fan, and he even volunteered to play the Fluke Man.
Fluke Man.
Yeah, no, it's great. He's like a brilliant albino cousin of the creature from the Black.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real.
It scares me of toilets, too. I mean, it makes me terrified of, like, toilets.
Okay, now for the directors of note, who are mostly Kim Manners.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
He directed just about everything that was good and terrifying. Humbug, The Hun, The Burlettes, Kaddish, Chinga, Leonard Betts, Sanguinarium, War of the Caprophages, I'll say that again later. Overall, 51 episodes over the series. That's more than a quarter of all the episodes. Sadly, Kim Manners died in 2009 from lung cancer. Darren Morgan, who transitioned from directing, paid homage to Manners in the one good episode from this newest 10th season, Mulder and Scully Meet the Weremonster.
That was the best one.
Yeah, where Mulder is kind of like drinking his sorrows away at a cemetery, and he's leaning up against Manners' tombstone. That was the best episode of that season.
Yeah.
It was 1 out of 6. That's not a great batting average.
No.
It was a great.
I really liked it, though.
Yeah, it was for the week. It was X-Files doing what it does best.
Which is what it should stick to.
Other directors of note, we've got Rob Bowman, who directed the first X-Files movie in 1998. He also directed 34 episodes of the show, including Paperclip, 731, Piper Maru, Jose Chung's From Outer Space.
Uh-huh. That's a great one. Actually, I really love that one.
That would star Charles Nelson Reilly. Chung, the novelist it was one of these like Rashomon stories where everybody's giving differing opinions on events, and it's one of the rare instances where the X-Files does like black comedy incredibly well.
They really do. The LA episode is also great, where they're making the movie. Taleone is so funny. Oh my god.
Yeah, and I think from that one, I sort of associate like ex-cops, which is both funny and actually really scary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really challenges the format, considering it's like a POV episode of Cops that just happens to then tag around with Scully.
Right.
While I don't initially come to the X-Files for horror comedy, the occasional...
It's kind of good.
Knocks it out of the park.
Duchovny's funny.
Yeah, he's got...
Throughout the whole season, he's... Or the whole series, you know, except for this latest stuff is not that funny, but it's pretty funny.
Yeah, he's really good on Larry Sanders. He sort of plays like an ambiguous, like, potential gay love interest. Like, at times he does, Duchovny does the Sharon Stone leg cross from Basic Instinct.
Uh-huh.
Really funny. But, so yeah, for a guy who, I think I'm one of the people who also kind of gives him crap for having a sort of narrow spectrum of acting ability. What he does very well. And so I appreciate that. I never need to see him cry ever again.
No. The crying is very uncomfortable.
That's why I can leave out any shows that deal with his sister.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't need to see him cry.
The crying is very uncomfortable. But he runs really well. He's a good jogger.
Everybody works. Well,
he runs in like every episode.
I suspect he is like a fitness guy.
Yeah.
Do you indulge in like the shirtless Duchovny episodes?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty freaky.
In the first like two seasons, he jogs in every single episode. In like the first two, yeah.
Coming in from a run.
Yeah, because he's a runner guy.
Also in league with some of the greatest directors is David Nutter, who directed 15 episodes, including Tombs, Blood, Little Green Men, Too Shy, and Firewalker, which is one I'm going to talk about. He's now a Game of Thrones guy, having directed 6 episodes of that. We've got R.W. Goodwin, who directed 9 episodes, including The Erlmeyer Flask. By the end of the series, both Duchovny and Gillian Anderson had directed episodes. So, like, it was... Yeah, I love the, like, community of X-Files creators. And they're all, like, pretty cool about doing interviews. I was just listening to some stuff on Camille Nanjiani's show, The X-Files Files.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't updated in a long time. I don't know if he will. He's kind of got his hands filled with the... Big Sick publicity is movie.
Yeah, he's busy, you know, being really super successful.
Yeah, Silicon Valley too.
Yeah,
and Camille's the best. But so on his show, like towards the like second half, you know, of the episodes, he started getting on people who created the show, and he's got Darren Morgan and Glenn Morgan on episodes. He talks to Mark Snow about the.
Mm-hmm.
The iconic music that it turns out was kind of like a happy accident.
Right.
As far as the, there's a particular delay that we all kind of now think of synonymous with the X-Files.
So he walks out and I happen to have a certain kind of sound element on my keyboard. And I just put my elbow down accidentally, not too hard, but, and there was this, delay echo effect on this piano sound, and I heard it, and it was the sound of the da 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 da.
Yeah, oh wow.
And I thought, whoa, that's cool. So and then I thought, well, what about the notes, you know? So eventually I came up with the 4 notes, da ba da da ba da da ba da da ba da, and it had that, you know, echo.
Yeah.
Delay effect.
Okay, so the episodes we picked, I think we picked because they're episodes we come back to. They're the ones we watch and rewatch and watch again.
Right.
For my two, I picked 2 straight-up horror episodes, Kaddish and Firewalker. One is like a companion piece to the previous season's classic episode, Ice, to John Carpenter's The Thing, and the other is a haunting story of a widow looking for answers and Jewish mysticism. So Firewalker, I mentioned it, kind of plays as a companion piece of the previous season's episode, Ice.
I had made them be the same episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they do function as fire and ice. In this case, Firewalker refers to a robotic, it's essentially the Mars rover, but for an underground volcano region.
Mm-hmm.
These doctors who are, I guess, geologists and figuring out like whether or not like it's going to explode like Mount St. Helens,
mm-hmm.
and this sort of remote probe, And so here's the synopsis. When scientists watch as their camera picks up a moving shadow on the inside of a smoldering hot volcano, too hot for any living creature to survive, Mulder and Scully investigate the strange occurrence. That's a weird run-on sentence. Not line.
That description reminds me of kind of the one of the best scenes in this, which is when Mulder first sees the shadow footage, and he's so stunned by it. It's the same reaction on his face as in Godzilla versus Destroyer when they 3D the destroyers, yeah, and everyone goes, and Mulder does the same thing.
Now, look at this.
Whoa. What the hell is that?
We don't know.
So this episode is directed by David Nutter and written by Howard Gordon. It stars familiar faces Bradley Whitford, Mercer, Johnny Smith, and Hiro Kanagawa. And yeah, I love this. It plays into all the fun, you know, the thing type stuff as far as remote location, lost contact. In this case, they're not drilling, but they're just exploring an underground volcano. And so, yeah, so when they discover that there is an organism that is not recognizable, it's always convenient that they have exactly the right scientific equipment to study, essentially DNA level differences between organisms. And so they sort of recognize that this is not a carbon based organism, the way every living thing on Earth is a carbon based organism. This is a silicon
describes the metabolism from hydrogen sulfide into silicon dioxide.
Doesn't that suggest a silicon-based life form?
But the fundamental building block for every organism known to man is carbon, from the smallest bacterium to the largest redwood tree.
Yes, but silicon is the closest element to carbon. It reacts almost identically with other elements the way it combines to form complex molecules. A silicon-based life form in the deep biosphere has been one of the holy grails of modern science, and maybe Trepko's found it.
Mulder, that is science fiction. It's some elaborate construct from a delusional mind.
It's most akin to like a killer fungus.
Right.
Yeah, killer fungus.
I know you do. This has everything you like.
Yeah.
It really, like isolation and quarantine and fungus. And not only fungus, but like fungus that has spores that explode out on top of people, affecting people who might not even know they're affected by it.
Yeah.
It's really everything that you like in one show.
It is. It's a story. It's got paranoia. It's got like a remote, like high stress location. Everybody questioning each other.
Yeah.
Samples 7, 12, and 22 also contain trace evidence of the organism. The possibility of this new, or perhaps unfathomably old, life form has left me sleepless, wondering if I haven't lost all perspective.
Can I have a sidebar here? I got a Mindy's Music Corner because something was kind of making me irritated, and I want to put a stop to it right now. In the beginning, there's a mention of Bradley Whitford being Mozart, and then the other doctor is Salieri.
I always played Salieri to his Mozart. I was never quite on his plane of intellect.
Let's talk about Salieri. Everyone hates Salieri and they think that he was less than Mozart.
It makes it look like he's like the villain.
Poisoned him or whatever. But it's not true. Mozart actually went out of his way to kind of be like picking at Salieri for a lot of his early life. He would write these letters like Salieri's up to his tricks. He kept referring to these tricks. And really, the difference with Salieri and Mozart is that Mozart didn't like the Italian school of music. So Mozart representing German school of music, Salieri definitely representing the Italian. Mozart had a thing with Salieri. It wasn't that Salieri really even cared. Salieri, just last year, they found a piece that Salieri and Mozart worked together. So along their Mozart's short life, they actually became friends. And Salieri actually premiered a couple of his works as a conductor, a couple of Mozart's works. So
writers.
Yeah.
Know that, yeah, Salieri and Mozart were not enemies, or at least you couldn't blame Salieri for any animosity between them. Mozart.
Exactly. I just wanted to have like a little sidebar there.
Yeah, I do love the speculative science in this one. The idea that a silicon-based parasite could be, you know, older than, I mean, it's almost equivalent to like the water bear as far as resilient creature that could sustain itself in the volcano's temperatures, and then it becomes this terrifying thing to human beings because we didn't sort of co-evolve.
Along the lines of the water bear, I don't know if you've ever done a lot, you know, I go on these crazy tangents of documentaries, but if you've ever watched any documentaries on the animals that live deep down in the ocean that feed off of like the volcanic vents and things like that, this really reminded me of that because they literally like eat hot. That's what they do. And that's how they live. And I was like, ooh, maybe they're silicone based life form. Yeah. Then I start thinking all sorts of crazy shit.
Yeah, well, it's the perfect X-Files premise that it's got just enough science where you're comfortable taking that leap.
Mm-hmm.
I really do love that. And then, yeah, you throw in, I mean, no one plays Paranoid better than Leland Orser.
Mm-hmm.
You found sand in his lungs?
Silicon dioxide. The waste product of a silicon-based organism.
Wait a second. There's no such thing as a silicon-based organism.
Maybe now there is.
Our listeners would know him as the guy from Seven who sort of was forced to use the blade.
Yeah.
He had a gun, and he made it happen. He made me do it. He put that thing on me, and he made me wear it. Then he told me to fuck her.
Okay, I think on the show in the past I've probably shown some love to Bradley Whitford, that there might be a man crush there. I'm not going to call it out specifically.
That's okay. He seems to have space madness, even though we're not in space.
And he's got like second degree burns on his face, for which he's not giving a whole lot of care.
Because he's down in the hot. Oh, for which he's not giving. I thought you were like, for which we don't know why, where they came from, but
no.
Yeah.
No, he's chosen to live in a volcano.
Yeah. He's like the monster from Sunshine. Firmly planted in the 90s. We have Shawnee Smith with the shortest, spikiest bangs that you could ever imagine what a grad student having.
It was a wig. It was conspicuous.
It's so 90s.
Not that kind of stuff, but
I just called her short bangs. And then I was like, oh, it's the girl from Saw.
Yeah.
Who's also a musician, but like a badass kind. Like, she's in a band with the guy who's now in Metallica. Yeah, Robert Trujillo.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I had even more reason to like Saw.
I know. And I was like, short bangs. And then I found more about her, and I go, okay, fine.
Yeah. I love the, I don't know how much I'm spoiling, but once they sort of recognize the limitations of this spores outbreak, when Scully has to like sort of figure out what to do before she pops.
Uh-huh.
That handcuff scene, I love that. That was really terrible. The practical effects are pretty solid in this. There you see a couple wrinkles in the sort of latex necks, but yeah, I really it was creepy. You didn't know what to expect other than like there's something inside that body and then once out.
Yeah, no, it's a great one. I definitely know why you chose it. So I'm on board.
Please notify FBI District Headquarters in Spokane that our party is quarantining itself due to possible contagion. Have CDC set up an evacuation unit on high alert.
What's the nature of the contagion? Agent Mulder?
Tell them it's a biological agent of unknown origin.
That's affirmative. Standing by.
My first pick was War of the Coprophages, and I remember this because cockroaches skeeve me out.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I immediately thought to the Creepshow anthology piece.
That was one of the creepiest ones. Yeah.
I
don't like cockroaches. They're so gross. So I chose that one, and I also chose Detour.
Yeah.
Which is one that still scares the shit out of me.
I like Detour so much, I started lumping other episodes into that in my memory.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I also, with the cockroach one, I also kind of put them together. And even when I went back to watch Firewalker, at first I was like, oh, Darren picked this because this is like the thing. And I put both of those episodes together.
Fire Ice.
Yeah, and I was like, wait, I think that's in the snow, that other episode. I could not get it together.
Behold the mighty cockroach. Believed to have originated in the Cerulean period over 350 million years ago, they can be found in every part of the world, from the tropics to the Arctic. There exists 4,000 known species, And in a year, a single female can produce over 500,000 descendants. Radiation doesn't kill them. By evolutionary standards, they are nearly flawless creatures. But creatures, nevertheless, possessing only a simple nervous system, their behavior is dictated solely by responses to environmental stimuli. Unlike us, they are incapable of thought, of self-illumination. Compared to the roach, we are gods and must therefore act accordingly.
War of the Coprophages is in the third season. It's the 12th episode. And this is one of those, and this happened a lot in this particular season, that Skulder and Mulder.
We're going to do that.
Mulder and Scully are not in a lot of scenes together, and they kind of started separating them at this point.
Yeah, I think they were very diplomatic in sort of talking about the tension between them at a certain point.
So
it was best to sort of limit their exposure to one another.
And they spent a lot of time just talking on the phone to one another.
They started ramping up the cell phone usage between them. It seemed like the more problems there were between them.
Yeah.
In the fourth season, they seemed to settle their shit for the most part.
Yeah, then it comes back in just before Duchovny leaves later on in another season, and they're so aggressive to each other. I literally thought I missed episodes where they had a fight. But that's just the way it was.
This episode, at times, comes off like almost the writers and producers were punishing Jillian.
Yeah.
Because they kind of relegate her to, like, I mean, she's like giving Queequeg a bath, but she's walking her dog while Mulder's on a case. Like, it's weird.
Well, because they went through this phase with, I don't think they always knew what to do with Scully, and that is something about the writing that kind of doesn't always
serve.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't know what to do with her. They were like, should she have this relationship? Oh, okay. And the relationship was not a successful thing. No one cared about that. So then they gave her Queequeg, and then they have her whole thing with Bill and the rest of her family.
Yeah.
You know, but in this episode, they're spending most of their time talking on the phone. I was happy to see Queequeg, though.
One of the episodes I was confusing was actually Queequeg's demise down the line. That's not the name of the episode, actually. That one's quite minor.
What if it was? That's the best title ever. This one was directed by Kim Manners, written by Darren Morgan. I mean, yeah, no, Darren Morgan, not you. This was originally premiered in 1996, so like you would have been like 10.
Like 14, what, 96, 15.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. The synopsis reads, the agents come to the aid of a town seemingly under attack by killer cockroaches. And it's a Mulder episode.
Yes.
And he's like on vacation. I think the point is that they're both supposed to be, you know, getting into some downtime. And so Mulder is wearing like a mock turtleneck that's really flowy and baggy because it was the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. He wasn't going jogging that day. He's sitting in his car at the very beginning because he had heard that there had been some flying UFO activity.
Yeah.
So he's just sitting there. The great scene starts out. A cop comes up alongside of him, notices David Duchovny looks like a freaking weirdo parked in the road.
Yeah.
You know, being a creep. Yeah. And so it's really funny, and he's getting hassled by the cops. And I like that scene. That was nice.
I heard reports of several UFO sightings in this area last night. Did you see anything?
No, sir, not personally. But we did receive a lot of telephone calls.
Any more calls tonight?
No, sir.
So it doesn't take much digging to find that coprophagia is the consumption of feces, which fun name to give to an X-Files episode, but so much worse when you think that like these are like people eating cockroaches.
Uh-huh.
You know, before they arrived at you as duty.
Gross.
That's so much worse to think of those crawly legs on you.
It makes Snowpiercer even worse that way.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 In this case, the cockroaches are showing up. Usually, like, they'll be witnessed on somebody, mm-hmm. and at the drop of a dime, they scatter and disappear forever.
Right.
And so that they've eaten a person alive in the span of a couple minutes is pretty shocking to everybody around. They don't call the CDC, though. That's a weird move.
Well, just because, you know, know, Mulder happens to be there, so he just tags along. That's the other thing, too, is that, like, the local law enforcement's handling it, and then Mulder's just like, oh, I'm out here being a weirdo, and then the cop is like, come on in. I got this other guy gotten killed by cockroaches.
You look trustworthy. You and your mock turtleneck.
The FBI keeps tabs on these things?
No.
So he calls Scully in the very beginning of this episode. He calls her and is kind of telling her what's going on, because very much at this is really X-Files hitting the swing here in the season three. Mulder just will believe anything you tell him. And he takes it at face value. So he calls Scully and she's like, are you telling me this thing? And this is a very like cut and dry one of these. Now, we know from other episodes that Mulder, he knows the difference about properties of carbon and silicone and all sorts of things. Yet he's never heard of anaphylactic shock. When Scully mentions that to him, he's like, what's that? It's like, you know about physics and all sorts of shit.
Taking a CPR class. Like any sort of position to.
When she mentions this, it's a sudden revelation. And then he hangs up with it. You go, oh, it must be that.
Wow. He
hangs up the phone.
Wedging in a scene so that you could get both your actors talking to each other.
Exactly. I think she's actually bathing Queequeg at that point in time, too.
Yeah. So I mentioned that it does feel like they're almost punishing Gillian Anderson. I think it's immediately after that conversation, maybe the one right after, that like Mulder essentially hangs up on her, leaving her like questioning what the hell's going on.
Right.
And then the next scene is him flirting with a doctor named Bambi Barabom.
Yes.
May I ask why you're trespassing on government property?
I'm a federal agent.
So am I.
Agent Mulder, FBI.
Dr. Barenbaum, USDA, Agricultural Research Service.
Well, Dr. Barenbaum, I'm going to have to ask you a few questions.
For instance?
What's a woman like you doing in a place like this?
Yeah, Scully is literally waiting by the phone. They cut away to Scully waiting by the phone for Mulder to check back in. And there he is, flirting with the doctor. He, incidentally, is named after a prize-winning University of Illinois entomologist, Dr. May Barenbaum. I did really like her theory about how UFOs were actually swarms of bees, or not bees, but bugs.
It's my theory that UFOs are actually insect swarms. I don't know if you know anything about UFOs, but all the characteristics of a typical sighting are shared with nocturnal insects swarming through an electrical airfield. The sudden appearance of a color glowing light hovering in the night sky, moving in a non-mechanical manner, possibly humming, creating interference with radio and television signals, then suddenly disappearing.
There's nocturnal insect swarms. It's fascinating.
Everything about insects is fascinating.
But Mulder's not interested in that, because that's like a reality-based thing, and he's only wanting crazy shit at this point in time. There's also this scene where it's right around where he hangs up with her. Then Scully calls back, and Mulder's talking to Dr. B. I mean, he's like, not now. He hangs up. He's so mean. He's so, like, rude.
This episode is so hard.
It's so bad.
Does my scientific detachment disturb you?
No, actually, I find it quite refreshing. Not now. You know, I have always found insects to be very interesting.
The mention of the 90s rumor of Africanized killer bees, not to be confused with the Wu-Tang's killer bees, I did like that sort of nod, because that became urban lore. It turns out it was complete bullshit. Like, there was not a swarm of Africanized killer bees on its way to America to terrorize us. That never actually happened, but it got a lot of news press. It even got, like,
I remember hearing about it, yeah.
This is the week about killer bee swarms. But in any case, I guess it sounds, to Chris Carter, it sounds enough like the premise for a show that someone would weaponize bugs somehow and be like perfect assassin.
The 90s was really afraid of bees. Like, my girl, like, it was terrifying. People were so afraid of them. So let me ask you, because I know you're a huge fan. Is that Michael Parks in the hotel?
I looked it up. No. No, it's not. I mean, well,
I Googled it. I was like, is Michael Parks in the X-Files?
Looks just like him. And yeah, we lost Michael Parks.
Right. But I saw him and I go, who is this?
Yeah, if it was, it was a like shockingly small part. It's like, you want to play a cameo role?
Do you want to walk up in a hotel?
I'm sure he'd say, like, what's the X-Files? But yeah, not just a guy that looks like him.
Now, Dr. Bambi and Mulder, Mulder's trying to flirt. Dr. Bambi, I'm not really sure if she's interested or you can't really tell. She's not a very good actor. But she's like having all this insect junk. Well, not junk. Like, no, I mean like insect, like, why can't I do it? I mean like insect, like dick jokes. Yeah, and it's supposed to be sexy, I think. Like, Mulder thinks it's sexy. Is she trying to be I'm confused.
Are you trying to suggest that Bobby Phillips be Bobby Phillips from Showgirls fame? Isn't a great actress, is that what you
want? I just didn't know if I was supposed to be, like, also thinking that Dr. Bambi was sexy when she was telling me about how bugs' dicks are.
I don't know.
I was really confused.
Because I didn't get the sense that she was, like, flirting with him.
But all she can talk about is bug dicks. And Mulder is definitely into it.
Yeah, well, he's into her and anything that comes out of her mouth, yeah.
But I'm, after watching all of that with between the two of them, I started to think that I don't think Dr. Bambi's even a doctor. I don't think she's an entomologist at all.
She's just a creepy bug lady who likes to wear shorts.
Yeah, because she only, like, whenever she's, like, looking at them under the microscope, she only goes the microscope. She only looks at, like, their junk.
And come to think of it, that creepy house that Mulder sort of accidentally winds up inside, that one bug study, she's in that place in shorts, like, right?
Yeah.
Just my memory. Did I put her in shorts? Did I
catch? I think she's in shorts.
I read that she was in Richie Diaries and Showgirls.
Maybe.
I'm sure she was in shorts. And it was conspicuous on account of, like, no, everyone's full of bugs. You don't want to tuck in your pants into your socks.
But she likes it.
Early on in the episode, we get two stoners played by Tyler Levine and Nicole Parker.
Yes.
Who are together in more than just this episode.
Yes, they are.
Meyer, which we mentioned.
Yeah.
And the also aforementioned Mulder and Scully meet the weremonster.
Yeah.
I kind of, they're just like British Columbia's resident stoners.
Yeah.
And all the...
I love to see them.
Yeah, you know, one of the other guys is also... Yeah, Kevin Smith put him in a movie and he was... Yeah.
And the Levine guy, he's in Tucker...
Tucker and Dale Fight Evil?
Some one of those. Two last things worth mentioning. Scully freaks out and, like, shows everyone her badge and, like, pulls rank in a gas station / convenience store. And then she steals candy from the store.
I don't remember her stealing.
She takes the malted milk balls off the floor, eats them, and walks out with the milk balls.
Yeah, she's also
thief.
Just way more subtle.
Exactly. Because she's got a badge, waving that badge around. And then my last bit, and it's something you'll notice when you, as the show, if you watch the show all the way through, Mulder goes through this phase, especially in season 3, where he's very chivalrous. And in this case, he makes Bambi wait in the car because he's being really chivalrous. And it reminded me, as I was rewatching for this episode, I was like, oh, I forgot he did that. He does that with Scully, like, so many times.
Yeah, I mean, when it's his partner, it's especially condescending.
Yeah. But Bambi, like, studies bugs. Like, why should she stay in the car? She's the most important person in the whole show.
Bambi is the most important person in the show.
Mulder hadn't even heard of anaphylactic shock.
I will say, Mulder has a respect for putting people in danger, like, when it comes to quarantine nervousness. Like, he's very quick
yes.
to sit down.
So in doing research for this episode, I was listening back to some of Kumail Nanjiani's podcasts, and Darren Morgan's been on a couple of times, and I was surprised to hear that he doesn't like this episode, War of the Coprophages.
Yeah.
He struggled with, and he talks about being on the verge of quitting. Like, the script was due the next day, and he goes into Chris Carter's office, and he's like, he's just appears in bad enough shape that Chris Carter's like, you know what? Go home and take a nap, like sleep right. on it, because you're, this is clearly like ruining you.
I just wonder why. It's not a bad episode. I think it's a great episode.
Well, right, but like the split between Scully and Mulder, it's a different dynamic than other episodes.
Yes.
And I think it's probably there in the script. I think he talks about having a couple of good ideas, but then recognizing that like he didn't have an ending at that point in the office. He still needed a whole third act, and he still wasn't wild about it. He kind of talked about it not clicking.
Right.
And by comparison, Darren Morgan and Kim Mathers, they're the team that put together Humbug.
Right.
Which is a fucking great episode. It's like the X-Files does Freaks.
You know what I think I like about this is that it is different. It actually has a really different this feeling. Episode, yeah. You know, and the thing is, when you piecemeal X-Files like we're doing right now, just mm-hmm. piecemealing it, it does stand out sometimes maybe as a less than kind of episode. But when you watch it in the greater scheme of things, especially because of the weird, terrible tension that was going on with Skulder and Skulder and Molly, I can't stop and I won't stop. But it's like, it really was making people uncomfortable. So to see them separated at that point, if you're just going through and steamrolling the series, it's okay. You don't mind.
Right. This is the like rare case where the parents stay together for the kids and do work it out.
Exactly.
So fun facts you kind of stumble across in the X-Files guides. The name of the town in this episode is Miller's Grove,
yeah.
which is reminiscent of the Orson Welles' famous War of the Worlds radio play, which itself was a take on the Hindenburg disaster. But in this case, they use the town Grover's Mill, New Jersey, which yeah. Jersey represent every time. I will now.
What is it about New Jersey? Don't edit that out. I'm going to hop in you can't.
It's the densest populated state in the country, and so
a
lot
true?
Of stories.
Oh,
it
I guess
is true.
Because we have upstate New York ruining it for the rest of us to be like people on top of people.
Oh God! I mean, if New York State was as dense as New York City, yeah, that would be a horrible place to live.
Right?
It would just be like no resources left. But anyway, New Jersey, Grover's Mill, the original inspiration, and it speaks to the sort of townwide panic that occurs when you know people are sort of confronted right. with bugs. Not that long ago, New York faced like a bed bug epidemic.
It was.
And it was bad enough that our office was affected.
I remember. Roscoe the bed bug dog.
Roscoe the bed bug dog.
If anyone is out here on the East Coast and knows about Roscoe the bed bug dog.
He's a television star. but yeah, no, so our office was hit. There were areas like by my desk. And so I went home paranoid. And like
the paranoia is what gets you about bed bugs more than anything.
So at the time I was trying to like give myself some context or some amount of relief. And so I Wikipedia'd bed bugs and learned all sorts of terrible things about traumatic insemination.
I remember this.
But part of the traumatic effects are just like people being neurotic about it
yeah.
and becoming obsessed. And so like every mosquito bite or like irritation you
yes.
have, you're like double checking. You're like, does that look like a bed bug
bite? Is
this
three? Are there three here? Because then you've learned about how bed bugs bite. And you're like, is this on my, elbow pit? I
yeah.
don't know.
You're like with the lights off in the room, you're flipping your mattress
oh,
because
God.
You know that's
where
they
I went are. Through that phase. And anytime I would like, it was when we had it in the office and I would come home from work.
Yeah.
And I would just look in the creases.
You got to sneak up on them. Yeah,
you do have to sneak up on them.
So if
Thank
you could
God,
imagine it wasn't bed bugs, but cockroaches Ugh. Everywhere. Like you'd have to like burn your house down. Like I
yeah.
don't know what you do. You have to leave. You have to get out of there with none of those contents because they could all have cockroach eggs in them. And I totally get the paranoia reaction to bugs.
I think cockroaches are probably the most disgusting of bugs.
Yeah.
You know, they're just
and
so slimy and greasy, and I hate them.
Slimy and greasy?
They look
New York
slimy
cockroaches
and
people are a little different than.
Don't they look slimy and greasy? Yeah,
I mean, they've got
shiny.
A creepy sheen. Yeah.
yeah I don't yeah. like that at all.
Yeah, it'll catch the light. And yeah, just like bed bugs, they scatter yeah. when the light turns on. Yeah, I remember when we were talking about Creepshow and they sneak up on you, that segment. Romero talked about the like collection of cockroaches. And for this episode, they used 300 cockroaches.
Right.
They were like
there was a
showbiz
cockroach
cockroaches.
Yeah.
They talk about Kim Manners actually talking to the cockroaches.
Oh, right. He's directing cockroaches. Yeah. I love that. That's confidence. So the next episode we're going to talk about is probably one of my all-time favorites. I couldn't really, I don't know, the idea of a golem probably is what does it for me. But yeah. The episode we're talking is season 4, episode 12 or 15, depending on your guides, Kaddish. Directed by Kim Manners and written by Howard Gordon. Here's the synopsis. After a Jewish man was murdered in a Hasidic community, then his killers are found murdered one by one, Mulder and Scully will determine whether someone is extracting vengeance or if larger forces are at work. And so I've already talked about the golem idea. This episode is knee-deep in Jewish mysticism. We're talking like the Kabbalah era of like pre-Torah writings.
It's called the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, the earliest known Hebrew text on man's mystical communion with the divine.
Is it ever buried with the dead?
No. In observance of the Jewish belief that with death comes equality, the corpse is buried only in its shroud. No personal symbols of class or worldly position are allowed.
But he talks about filled with golems and dibbiks and demons. And I just, golems, dibbiks, and demons, like, if that's not a book already, that's, yeah. And
I would read
really,
that.
We geeked out on the dibbik idea in our possession two-parter. But yeah, so the idea that, you know, if one were to, like, approach the Talmud as, like, a series of X-Files episodes, you could totally write, like, an entire season around that stuff. Like, there's
absolutely
so much weird and bizarre and fun and
it's
sometimes
very
creepy
cool
stuff.
One of the first things, the first mentions of this golem is some rabbis were really hungry, and I think they were in a desert or in the mountains, and they're two guys together. They're very hungry, so they make a calf out of mud.
Okay.
And then they eat it. But I think it's more just, like, like those dirt cookies you read about people eating. But in the story, it's the calf comes to life and then they eat it. But they were probably starving and it seemed like real food, but it was really just mud.
It seems like in the cartoons when you were a kid, like people stranded in the desert would see an oasis and sort of, you know, run towards water and dive in and it's just dirt because they've gone mad.
Exactly, like exactly. That. There's some other great golems in Talmud history and one where a king in particular builds this golem because everyone's like fucking with his people. So he makes this golem and that golem goes like berserker on anyone who fucks with them, but you can't control it because it's a body without a soul.
Yeah.
So eventually he has to be the one who puts it down. And the idea is that life to be responsible for life or to live even in this world is both like full of promise and terror.
Yeah.
Equal parts. And I think it's the golem is a great representation of that. You know, it's a great idea for that. And we see the golem in Psalms, actually, in the book of Psalms. It's mentioned, but it just means like a mass of dirt or a mass of nothingness, essentially, in Psalms when it's referred to.
That's interesting. It plays a big part in The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, the Michael Chabon book. And I think we never see it. And I think when that case is eventually opened, it's just sand in there.
Mm-hmm.
But it does kind of play as this great plot device. But what you said reminded me, there's a quote from Glenn Morgan, not the writer of this episode, but, you know, sort of X-Files royalty. He said, the best monster is the monster who doesn't want to be one.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
That's like such like the Frankenstein archetype. Mm-hmm. And actually the golem is...
Frankenstein is a golem, the monster.
There's a silent film called The Golem from 1915. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a, you know, a silent film, but it was a precursor to James Whale's Frankenstein, and Frankenstein is in his own right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as far as the plot, it opens with essentially a hate crime. Like it's essentially like a New York bodega. I don't know if the rest of the country calls them, like whatever, it's a corner store.
Yeah, like a deli's.
We're watching white supremacists essentially execute a Hasidic Jewish man,
mm-hmm.
and it's meant to be like jarring and traumatizing, and as intense as it was, that was a script change. It was originally written to take place in the black community, and Crown Heights, for those of you not familiar, especially this is an older story, but it happens to be exactly where I live, and the neighborhood is very like divided between the Hasidic Jewish community and the African American and West Indian community. And there were the Crown Heights riots, and I won't go into the whole deal, but like there were racial tensions for years between these two groups. And the original script was kind of, you know, meant to be natural and sort of inherent to that area and that place and time.
He was going to be a Louis Farrakhan kind of guy.
Yeah. It could have been not a classic. I think if it had gone down that road, it probably would have gotten a little too, it would have drawn attention away from the like the creepy mystical elements and just became this like sort of powder keg of an episode. Right. But in this case, we do have more generic white supremacists. There's a guy who owns a print shop where he's printing literature. And that was one of my favorite scenes. It happens pretty early in the movie, but they sort of...
The episode. It is like a movie, though.
Yeah, these best episodes really feel just like one-hour film, or not even 44-minute films. In this case, so Mulder and Scully track down a lead that this guy has sort of been antagonizing the neighborhood with his hate literature. And we watch this like sort of like twofold dynamic where he initially greets them and he's very cordial.
Right.
And then, you know, when they announce themselves as FBI, now they are part of Big Brother. And this guy's facade starts buckling little by little. And we watch this guy who is, you know, he's an anti-Semite. He's a you know, scumbag of a human being. But when the facade falls, by the end of it, he's accusing Mulder of being a Jew.
Yeah.
Like, it's really uncomfortable.
You work for them too, don't you?
Who?
You know who you look like you might be when yourself.
We work for the FBI, sir.
Who's the FBI work for? That's right. You call me paranoid because that's exactly what they want you to do. But there is one thing you can't call me, and that is a Zionist collaborator.
One of those white supremacists in the very beginning is one of my favorite people to see. I see him and I love seeing him. Shannon Rowe. I love seeing that man. He's in everything in the 90s, only bit parts, and never really on a show that lasted too long. So the X-Files for him was really a great find, even though it was only one episode.
The music in the episode, as most if not all episodes, is by Mark Snow. And whereas normally he's just kind of like building in with like, you know, occasional chords and sort of rising noises, here he plays really heavy with the like Hebraic flute music.
Yes.
And so I expect the Kol Nidre, the Aramaic prayer sung by Jews at the opening Day of Atonement services on Yom Kippur Eve. I suspect that plays a part in it because he's certainly like drawing from elements that we haven't heard in the X-Files. And it really, I don't know, it builds a world. And, you know, we should sort of mention that like the Hasidic community, it's an insular culture.
Incredibly.
And so having Mulder and Scully trying to conduct an investigation in this community where, like, no one's talking to them. Like,
no, I mean, it's a strange thing that I think until you live maybe in New York or around, you know, an Hasidic community, it's hard to understand, actually, because you're saying, why won't these people help the police in their investigation? But that's the way it is here in New York.
They've got their own
They have
cops.
Their own police. Yeah, and not only police officers, part of the NYPD, but also a street group of people who are the police for the Hasidic community as well.
Yeah, so there's resistance. And in this case, the only person who is willing to talk to Scully and Mulder is the...
Wait, you did it too.
Scully and Mulder?
Yeah.
The only person who's willing to talk to Mulder and Scully is the widow. I mean, they were planned to be married soon after, but it was her husband who died in that hate crime. And she, you know, she shows them the wedding ring that they were going to use, which it turns out, like, the story she tells is pretty close to the actual story of that ring as far as, like, being carried through the Holocaust by this rabbi. Incidentally, the, like, true story, that rabbi wound up marrying together two of Howard Gordon's friends. And so they they were sort of informing the episode, but the ring is the actual artifact.
That's amazing. Because I'm wondering, like, when I saw the ring come out, you're like, this is
it's
a very unique
ornate. Yeah,
thing.
It's very clearly like a piece of ceremony because it, you know, it's not the kind of thing you would wear out.
No, because everyone who gets married at that particular shul would wear that ring for the service, and it's very cool. What a great tradition.
Yeah. It was in one of the guides that I had read, told the story that an advisor to this episode, at least initially, was a Hasidic Jewish rabbi who on the DL was a big X-Files fan.
That's funny.
And I guess, you know, enough like intermediaries put them together with Howard Gordon writing the episode until his community kind of got word and found
and then
out.
And like, stop.
And then he had to pull out and he was just like, they don't approve.
Yeah.
But I was like, that's awesome. That's awesome. That I mean,
like
X-Files fans
off
are everywhere.
To watch the X-Files.
So the title of the episode, Kaddish, is a hymn of praises to God found in the Jewish prayer service, and specifically the mourner's Kaddish, said as part of the mourning rituals in Judaism prayer services. Mourners say the Kaddish to show that despite the loss, they still praise God. And so as this episode kind of evolves, the crux of the episode follows that someone is killing off these white supremacists, these anti-Semites who killed Isaac at the beginning of the episode, but there eventually Isaac is on camera at the location of another murder, and you know, Scully goes into skeptic mode and goes like,
the Brooklyn homicide detectives contacted the FBI civil rights branch with an interesting set of fingerprints that they pulled off of the boy's body.
Interesting how?
Interesting in that they belong to Isaac Loria.
Risen from the grave to avenge his own death?
Some people might assume that. It's probably what someone would like us to think.
But you have your own idea.
I think that this is a crime of hatred, like the crime that spawned it. A hatred that goes back 4,000 years. But masquerading as something else here. A callow attempt at murderous retribution disguised as spectral justice.
Do you want me to believe, Mulder, that blah, blah?
But so now we've got like we don't know if it's a reanimated corpse. We don't know what's going on.
Because we know the corpse is in the coffin because Shannon Rowe gets a face full of him.
I got it open, man! Get down here! Hey, Clint, check it out!
And it's very creepy.
It was very like, it felt almost like a Hammer horror film as far as like, you know, sort of squirrely villains being like terrified at the idea that like, you know, what if this guy that we killed isn't dead?
Right.
And we got to go dig up the body. It's like, that is a terrible idea. Like that is not based in logic. That is panic.
Yeah.
But in this case, they do go after the body and it's there where they left it.
Right.
And because, you know, Hasidic Jewish traditions, like, they don't embalm bodies.
Nope,
so
it's just there.
It's in rough shape. Oh. The big hurdle that Scully and Mulder were facing was getting permission to exhume the body and the community being very resistant to that. But now that it's a crime site, like, it's kind of like their job's been done for them.
Right.
And that's where they find the Talmud.
Which not only do they find it, it's now on fire.
Spontaneously combusts.
Yeah.
Very X-Files.
But then it could be the paper, it could be this and that, and Scully makes the whole thing
up. I love
up.
That Scully has like a very quick solution for what could have happened.
Has it ever been known to spontaneously combust?
No, it hasn't. It's a book on mysticism, not mysticism itself.
Is it printed on any special paper or with any special ink?
No, it's just a book. Leather and paper. Now, I suspect somebody might be trying to play a trick on you.
There is a possibility that moisture may have leached into the coffin, into the binding and the pages of the book. If the groundwater was contaminated, arsenic or arsine gas could have created a combustible mixture.
I might be romanticizing this episode a little bit, but I do kind of love that there is this great symmetry to this story, how Isaac's death sets off this chain of events not unlike the biblical story where Isaac's potential sacrifice serves as a test of faith for his father. In this story, we have a widow who's willing to like put her love above all things, mm-hmm. her faith included. And, you know, the kind of perversity comes from that. And so it's got great components. When we're in Golem POV, mm-hmm. it's almost like a straight up giallo film.
Yeah.
Like we are watching him murk dudes from his point of view with his like, you know, his soily hands.
Yeah, exactly. Filthy hands.
Made from clay. Okay, to close it out, you've got the episode that could be the episode I've watched the most, which isn't to say it's my favorite of all time, but it's up there.
It's up there. It's not my, I guess, my most favorite of all time. Because as I keep watching these, I think of more and more other ones that I'm like, this and that and that.
Yeah.
But this one to me still scares the shit out of me anytime I watch it. Episode 4 from season 5, Detour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Directed by Brett Dowler, but Kim Manners comes in with the assist in this episode.
Oh, is that right?
Helping. Yeah. He helped with this one.
I did look him up, and Brett Dowler is primarily a special effects guy. And this was his only episode that he directed of The X-Files. So, yeah, I guess that narrative starts to make a little sense that he might have needed some rescuing.
Kim Manners jumping in for the assist. Whatever. Written by Frank Spotnitz.
Yeah.
So it's a nice, tight script. Let me just give you the synopsis here, the IMDb synopsis. There's two. I'm going with the longer one. It's better. While driving down to Florida with two other FBI agents to attend a team-building seminar, Scully and Mulder are drawn into the disappearance of several men in a wooded area. Rumors are soon circulating in the nearby town that there are monsters in the woods. Mulder soon believes there is definitely something in the woods causing these deaths, and nature itself may be seeking revenge in the form of invisible creatures. Of course he does. He and Scully go off into the woods and encounter the creatures firsthand.
Yeah, I love that the name of the episode comes from the point that they were on their way to like a team building group activity that the FBI was sending them.
And they're with these like southern versions of Mulder and Scully.
Really straight-laced.
Yeah, it's not at all fun, but they're talking about how much fun they had in their team-building seminar.
I was a little surprised at how much Mulder gets away with, like, just being the shit heel in the back seat and sort of, like, you know, making snide remarks here and there.
My notes actually said, them. To other outside people, Mulder and Scully have to seem like such snobby shits, you know, and they're so weird. Everyone else has to be like, those two are the weirdest people in the entire bureau.
I was just listening to Darren Morgan talk about Jose Chung from Outer Space mm-hmm. and the idea that that story is sort of, you know, at times we get the outsider's look of Mulder and Scully, and Scully comes off as like intense and authoritative, and Mulder is like robotic.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that's funny that like, yeah, we've had years with Mulder and Scully. So at this point,
right.
They're just, you know, Mulder's being a dick as he can
We're
be.
Just like used
he's,
to it.
He's, yeah, he's, he can be a little antisocial at times, depending on the company. And so we're not, we're with them in the back seat, kind of laughing along and get the jokes, but like, he's being a dick.
Yeah, but those other two people are such like herbs, you know? Like,
yeah.
I mean, come on.
But so when they sort of get diverted by whatever local authorities are looking into missing people in those woods. Also, I assume this was also shot in like British Columbia, like Vancouver area. Yeah. That area might be one of the most dynamic ever because this was supposed to be like a Florida Everglades swamp.
Yeah, I kept kind of being like, where are we at right now?
It wasn't quite as rainforesty as those Florida areas can be, but still like pretty serviceable as like one of the in the woods stories for the X-Files.
The thing here, the whole mystery comes about when there's a traffic stop and Mulder just can't stay in the fucking car.
What's going on, officer?
Our little situation is on.
Thank you, Jesus. Where's he going?
And then he inserts himself into someone else's mystery.
Any opportunity for an escape at that point, like that was his escape hatch.
But it's like, she's like, I don't need your help. And he's like, let me help you. And she's like, no, thank you. And he says,
like, you don't know who I've just spent 2 hours in the car with. Let me help.
Get me out of here.
Can I help you?
My name is Fox Mulder. I'm an agent with the FBI.
FBI? Who called you guys out?
And nobody. We just got stopped at your roadblock. It sounds like you had a shooting.
Shots were reported, but we have no evidence of anyone being shot.
when we first see these monsters, which are like seemingly invisible at this point in time.
It's got like a predator effect.
Yeah.
It's blending.
Yeah, blending in except for the bright red eyes, which is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
The best thing ever. But we're kind of treated with seeing them here and there when finally they come into a house. And you can actually see them because they're not in their wooded environment.
What is it, Lewis?
It's in the house.
Scariest part of the whole show when you first see that little fucker in the hallway.
The scares in this episode, mm-hmm. like this functions as a horror movie.
It's a really scary show.
So you mentioned the red eyes, and I looked up because eventually Mulder does sort of start, you know, he very smoothly transitions into speculation mode and supposing what...
But it's not speculation. To him, it's facts. To you and I it's or like, anyone else, it's speculation.
It's like Scully has been known to say that, like, I don't believe it. I believe you believe it.
Right.
But that's it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So Mulder mentions the Mothmen of West Virginia, yeah. who were noted as having red eyes.
30 years ago, the town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, was terrorized for over a year by something. Killing livestock, terrorizing the people. Witnesses described them as primitive-looking men with red, piercing eyes. It became known as the Mothmen. I got an X-File dating back to 1952 on it.
What would that be filed next to? The cockroach that ate Cincinnati?
No, the cockroach that ate Cincinnati's in the C's. Mothman's over in the M's.
I looked it up on Snopes, and they're of the opinion that they're pretty sure the urban myth is a misidentified type of heron called a shite poke.
Interesting name. Like the name.
It might also be a sandhill crane, the second largest American crane, which stands almost as high as a man and has a wingspan of more than 7 feet. He said the red eyes could have been larger circles or bare reddish flesh around the crane's eyes.
That's interesting, except for, have you looked into Mothman? Do you know a lot about Mothman?
I don't know a lot about it. Well, just the Richard Gere movie.
I like Mothman. I like me some Mothman lore and stuff like that.
Okay. Does the crane make phone calls?
The crane doesn't. There's no crane. There's like something going on there in West Virginia, Point Pleasant, right? A crane didn't say a bridge was going to collapse and then a bridge collapses.
Right. A person did.
But a person with foresight. I don't know. The Mothman stuff is very cool. It's totally worth looking into. The fact that there are a lot of like G-men in the area before this all happens is also very interesting. These guys who had no business being there in suits at the time. There's a lot to Mothman, and I think you should don't dismiss it as a crane. Watch some documentaries. There's plenty.
Watch some documentaries.
Get on it.
On the Mothman of West Virginia. One of my favorite scares, and they regularly play with misdirect, and you start to recognize, and at the same time, Mulder and Scully are recognizing that they are dealing with something that is evolved to live in these woods, and mm-hmm. in these circumstances, it's smarter than we are.
Right.
And that's fucking terrifying to consider that, like, you're the prey.
Right.
You're the easy mark.
But it's like they recognize certain ways that these guys are hunting and yet do the same thing that Mulder just said it was doing. He said it's trying to split them up. That's what it did.
And he still totally
and then
goes
still
for it.
they split up.
Just disappeared.
Mulder is not on the screen.
But that leads into my favorite Where's Glazer scare.
Where's Glazer?
I love him. That's Anthony Rapp, who is just like all my like childhood like dreams come true and in one tiny blonde boy. Anthony Rapp from Rent. He's the original Mark from Rent. He's like, it's great to see him on TV. Anytime you see him, it's like seeing BD Wong on TV to me. It's like the same, like, yeah, there you are. I missed you. And then you forget that you missed them and you see them again and you're like, I missed you.
Yeah, at first glance, I thought he was Alan Tudyk. He is not.
No, he is not. He looks like it, though. I could see that.
A little bit.
They're in the woods. They have been separated. Some people are missing. Mulder and Scully just let a bunch of rounds just randomly go. They don't know where the rest of their party is.
Oh,
they're shooting at a thing that they cannot see. Number one, you have to report every bullet that comes out of your gun.
Right.
Well, which Scully had, I think, about 13 actually come out of hers, which is a magic gun that she has. But that's okay. And then she wastes one trying to make a fire. So she had a lot of ammo in that one tiny clip there. But they're just letting rounds go like wild.
Yeah, well, they were panicked. I mean, I'd be scared shitless in that circumstance.
I understand that you're panicked, but you can't just go like bang, bang, bang.
I think what gives me more pause is, yes, the idea that their compatriots could have been in those woods,
yeah,
and they're not even looking out for the like flame orange hats.
Just fire that gun, Mulder. Keep doing it.
So this episode does actually have a couple like really, you know, funny and sometimes sweet moments between Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
And I had confused this one with Quagmire on account of like they're stranded in Quagmire. They're on a rock in the middle of like a pond or a lake. In this case, they're having to like camp out overnight. And
they
so they're huddled for
they
for warmth.
Become best friends in season 5. They are best friends. They have the best chemistry of all of the seasons.
Is that right? Okay.
They become best with friends. It's sort of sexual at this point in time, too. Sort of.
Yeah, they started moving that way. You kind of got the feeling that, like, the closer they got to the film, they wanted to make them a couple.
But they seem to actually enjoy each other's company. And so it comes to your favorite scene.
Yeah, where to comfort a wounded Mulder, he asks Scully to sing.
Why don't you sing something?
No. Mulder.
If you sing something, I'll know you're awake.
Mulder, you don't want me to sing. I can't carry a tune.
It doesn't matter to sing anything.
Jeremiah was a bullfrog. Was a good friend of mine. Never understood a single word he said, but I helped him drink his wine.
Chorus.
And it's so funny. And he demands the chorus. That's the best part. She's just going to sing the verse, and he says, chorus. Oh, the boys and I feel like even the tree people are like closing their eyes and like, oh, my God, this is still happening.
Maybe they're making a judgment call at that point. They're like, those people have like a brain disease. We shouldn't eat them.
Maybe they like the singing.
I mean, it does seem like you would get lonely out there. Do we want to spoil what the people are? Is
I don't know, because it is a good reveal.
It is. Okay. I'll leave it at that. We'll say this episode has a number of things in common. Many years before The Descent was ever made.
Yes.
But they share themes.
Yes.
And I love it for that. I love it for that. The premise is great. The idea that, like, ancient Florida was a pretty fucked up place for conquistadors to visit.
Yeah, yeah. These monsters are great. And sort of on that line of The Descent, it doesn't, I think, overshow them too much in this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And,
it does
and
a really
you really
good job
are focused in on their eyes, which are this bright red eyes, which is an amalgamation of people eyes and dog eyes.
Is that what was happening?
And that's, yeah, with a red filter. And that's how he made those with CGI. Everything else is constantly moving on the CGI, too. You never really get a good still shot of it. And so there's so much. I can absolutely see how Brett Dalher was a special effects guy.
Yeah, he's the right man for the job.
Because this is great. It's a great combination of the actual practical parts when you do see some practical work and then some CGI on top of it. Very cool stuff.
So we'll close it out there on this episode of X-Files episodes. This is kind of our best of, a cross-section. We did kind of recognize that, like, the more we nerded out over writers and directors, like, there are tons of episodes that we haven't watched 1,000
times.
There's
like 122 total, right? Episodes, or is there more?
I think there's like a little over 200.
Oh, my God. I'm crazy. Who knows where I got that number?
But so we'll probably be back at some point to the world of the X-Files, but that'll do it for now. Get in touch with us. We are at Rants Macabre on all social media. So that's Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
Yeah.
You can get in touch with us through email at therantsmacabre@gmail.com. And our website is therantsmacabre.com, where, you know, I always forget we have merch. We have merch available for you people.
We do have merch.
We've got stickers, buttons, and refrigerator magnets just waiting for you. Have a look.
Just send us a donate. No problems.
Yeah, there's that button. Makes it pretty easy on the website. Why don't you tell them about Patreon, Mindy?
Yeah, if you want other ways to give us your money, check us out on Patreon. We're on patreon.com/rantsmacabre, and we have a whole another collection back there.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. We have a lot of fun with the sort of alternative catalog.
Yeah.
And listeners have heard some of those episodes or pieces on this podcast. Most recently, we put up the Night of the Living Dead sort of mega episode.
Right.
And just as far as the timing of this, we did have George Romero leave this mortal realm. And so it was really heartbreaking to see that he was a guy who never stopped working. He had Road of the Dead like set in the pipeline, and he succumbed. I believe it was like lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But George Romero, you will be missed.
Yeah.
But yeah, we...
now that you've bummed everyone out.
Yeah,
we earlier in the episode, we mentioned... Anyway, we mentioned that we were going over our top 25.
Yes.
And so that's a little happier.
Night of the Living Dead is one of the few movies we can agree on in the top five, I think.
I think it's the only one we agree on.
That's how good it is. It brings people together. All right, so that'll do it for me. This is Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
The Rants Macabre. Cutting.
Cultured.
And curated.
And curated.